Accession number 20457, reel 19.
Brigadier Randall, reel 19. I think you were saying that the battalion had become a very efficient one by...
Yes, I think we had. I mean, obviously training was very important. Most of our training had been on-the-job training, but I always remember that aphorism of Wavell's, that training is the best welfare. Not Wavell, of Rommel. And it has to be said that, of course, the vast amount of materiel which we had, particularly enormous resources of air power, both in fighters and in air transport. I mean, air transport perhaps was revolutionized jungle warfare, and that was the one single ministry factor, which was a war weapon factor.
Did you ever actually have close air support in any of your attacks?
Or? Oh, yeah. I mean, when we were moving south from Mactilla to Piobwe, in that phase, I mean, I had a cab rank over my company, and I can't remember how it worked. I was thinking, oh, there. I mean, I could actually. I had a chap with me with a radio to that chap, and we'd say, look, we're going to fire some 3-inch or 2-inch water smoke at this place. Will you hit it? And then down would come these Vulti dive bombers or something, and it was called the cab rank. I mean, the morale effect of having that sort of air support flying over above and just coming down was colossal. I think another key fact was artillery. I think the British artillery techniques in Burma were first class. I mean, we did rarely get it right. I mean, we had guns centralized and so on. Whereas the Japanese never really used, they didn't have the quantities, and they used it in rather a haphazard sort of way. And of course we had tanks at all, which in central Burma was another a very, very, both in the retreat, of course, that armored brigade achieved a lot. So in the end, I suppose materiel or superiority, supremacy materiel was a big factor.
When you were attacking Point 900, did you have a cab rank available then? Could you have called in aircraft?
Well, it could have been then, but you see, the whole thing was so uncertain because we thought the Japanese had been in the mood to surrender. Mm. So it didn't seem any point in they must have been around, but we didn't use them anyway.
What about later on when you were down Piobwe? When you ran into...
Well, we used them most... It was mostly the Mactilla to Piobwe stage.
Yes.
See, we didn't actually push through 5-day until we were approaching Pegu. I suppose there must have been air attack. We must have used air on Pegu. It was still around. But then, of course, it was beginning to get the monsoon then.
Was that the case when you did when you had that bad day at Pegu when you were attacking there?
Yeah, no, it hadn't actually started. It started 2 days later after
yes.
that. But then, once you're closed up on the enemy, you can't really use air very easily. It's all right in a mobile situation, but once we've closed up, you know, when you're sort of eyeball to eyeball, you can't really use air. Then it's not a precise weapon. So I don't recall us using it there, though it must have been available if we'd wanted it.
Do you have an opinion about the value of the Chindit operations, which is a persistent, controversial
question?
Yes, I
do. I think that from a point... I mean, I think the men who did it did a wonderful... It was a great epic of human endurance and human courage. I think it was a perfect waste of time strategically. And I think it was a case of a very strange and... off mentally balanced man, being able to get the ear of people, to try allow him to prove his own strategic visions of war. I personally don't think. I go as far as saying not only did it not achieve anything at the Battle of Imphal, I think it very nearly lost us the Battle of Imphal because so much air effort was having to be diverted into supporting the Chindas. Whereas, I mean, the Battle of 1944 was won at Kohima and Imphal. You could argue, of course, that the fact that the Chindas were there diverted Japanese effort, but there isn't any evidence to support that. I mean, generally speaking, the Japanese pushed on to Kohima and Imphal and just ignored Chindas. So I think that, it was a very brave effort. I don't think it really achieved anything, and I think it ran very grave risks of diverting a lot of scarce resources to the wrong end.
You said that you were just settling down for rest, and then the dacoit business started. Who were the dacoits, and what were they doing?
Well, dacoity has been sort of endemic in Burma, and it still goes on, I believe. I never quite understood whether dacoits were sort of professional robber bands, or whether they were sort of like the English poacher, a respectable agriculturalist by day, and then at weekends or night you became a dacoit. The fact was that dacoit had been going on in Burma under the British long before the war, ever since the British were in Burma. They were robbers, and they would descend on a village or on a bus or something like that. They were usually out more for loot than killing, but they were quite prepared to kill people if they were very so they, about a month afterwards, they started up again, raiding villages, raiding buses. We were sent out on patrol. Then one day I was out with a company headquarters and I think one or two platoons, and they actually ambushed us. They ambushed company headquarters. They opened fire with a shotgun and some funny old weapons, and then came rushing out of the bushes with DARs. But of course, up against a sort of battle-hardened baton, they didn't stand a chance. I mean, about 5 minutes, it was all over. We wiped the lot out, and they never took us on again.
How many of them were there when that happened?
About 20 of them, I think. I mean, they just thought, the British, they are the sort of British we saw in the 1942. The British will run away, but of course, it was a very different sort of scene. We just wiped them out, Tommy guns and then a bayonet. And funnily enough, the shotgun which was fired at me, one of our Tommy gun bullets hit it, I had it. I've got a DAR from that. And I kept the shotgun. I took it to Germany after the war. I had a new stock put on it. I've still got it to this day. There aren't many chaps who've got a shotgun which was fired at them in anger. But then they tended to attack where they didn't think we were going to be. But we did a lot of very hard patrolling.
What sort of area, what size of area had you got as your area of
we had several 100 square miles, quite a big area. It was already between the Sitang and the Bilin River. And I was sent out to another occasion. I was out with a couple of platoons, we came round the corner, and there was this bus being held up by dacoits. And there were some extremely pretty Burmese women sort of standing there wringing their hands. and these Burmese were so sort of engrossed in it. They had now, and then suddenly the chap looked round. It was like one of these sort of stage villains. His face absolutely, God, you know, I mean, they had no idea there were any sort of British forces anywhere near them. And so we sort of opened darts, one platoon left, and then we charged through fixed bayonets, and we just drove these chaps through the village. We were supposed to take them prisoner, but one or two of my fleeter chaps, I remember actually the leading platoon, actually overcaught this chap and shoved a bayonet through him, and I said, oh, steady on, we're not going to kill him, we're taking him prisoner. We were going on for a couple of days, so I remember handing these dacoits over to the head man, and I said, you will look after these dacoits, and I want them back alive when I get back. And when we got back, those dacoits were very, very pleased to see me. They'd had a very hard time. And then we had a brigade sweep. We had companies all around, bringing it great, us and the Gurkhas, and then we all sort of swept in the net, but they sort of slipped away into the jungle. But gradually we got on top. We caught their leader, a chap called Narmo. The Gurkhas had an interesting thing. You remember the thing called a Q ship in the First World War?
Yes.
They had a Q bus. They got this bus, and they, in the middle of it, they put a whole lot of sandbags, and they had a sort of stay-behind party there. And then they got a whole lot of Gurkhas dressed up as women. And anyway, they trailed this bus up. Anyway, sooner or later, it was ambushed by this gang of dacoits. And all these Gurkhas dressed women sort of tripped away, ran away screaming and shouting. And then the dacoits sort of closed in. Then at the very last moment, when they were almost there, down came the sandbags, and about eight or nine Gurkhas opened up point-blank range with Tommy guns and then leapt out with kukris, wiped the whole bloody lot out, which I thought was a good bit of deception. But the trouble was, of course, you can only do that once, but it did mean it was safe to travel on a bus for quite a long time afterwards.
Deterrent effect.
Yes. It's not the sort of thing you get away with nowadays, but I mean, there was no civil administration. I mean, at one time I was made sort of acting district commissioner for an area.
What happened to these dacoits once they were captured and they were in the hands of the civil authority?
Well, we had a British police superintendent came along. I didn't really like it. They tortured these chaps. So I went in once. I don't approve of that.
The civil police?
Yeah, they had this chap sort of strapped down his neck and giving him a really good thrashing, which I didn't like very much. But it wasn't my concern.
Why were they doing that? Were they trying to get information?
Information, yeah.
Yes. Did it work, that method of questioning?
Well, we captured Narmo, the leader of this gang, and then we handed him over to the civil police, and then they let him out. I don't know whether it was treachery, I mean, in other words, somebody, or whether it was just incompetence, which made us pretty angry.
What, they let him go?
Yeah, he got away. But gradually we got on top.
What was the most effective sort of operation? Was it intensive patrolling, or was it?
We're getting no information really. So you could really only prophylactic patrolling, so to make it more and more difficult for them to operate. It didn't stop, but it didn't. We kept it under bar because they could never be certain. And because we did all these big sweeps and big things, we, to some extent, gained the initiative.
When you were doing patrols, were they mainly, were they in vehicles or were they on foot?
On foot. Oh, no, vehicle. Well, I mean, there was just one main road through, but the rest of it was just tracks. I mean, you could... I did some patrols right up in, you know, where you could... couldn't even get mules through. We used to carry our water and rations on mules, but sometimes it was so, the tracks were so narrow that you had to unload the mule. It was a beastly nuisance. I had to unload the mule and manhandle the things through. So they were foot patrols. But
what scale of patrol? You mentioned a couple of platoons going.
Well, we normally sent a sort of platoon out. That was a sort of the. But I mean, I've done a lot of patrolling all over the world. Patrolling is a lot of it has to be prophylactic because of the lack of intelligence. Really. Mm. It's not time wasted because it not necessarily in the context of Burma, but it does reassure the innocent people that you're around, and it obviously makes the enemy, or whatever you like to call them, or the baddies. I mean, it keeps them. Yeah, you know, it doesn't give them a free run. If you didn't do any patrolling, well, they would simply dominate an area. So that it's worth doing, but it's very time consuming and jolly boring for soldiers. Really, quite difficult to keep soldiers alert.
Did you have many random contacts as a result of?
I had a few. The one I mentioned.
Yes.
But they only two. I remember. I think the other companies had a few. Yes, but I mean the one where they ambushed me, the other one where we met them, but. So, gradually, I think the police were building up all the time, and somehow our intensity of our operations seemed to tail away because there were more and more police around.
Were these policemen locals, or were they?
Well, British? I mean, they brought in ex-Burma police officers, British officers, and then I think a lot of ex. But I mean, below that sort of DS. The sort of major district superintendent of police, they were Burmese. But I think a lot of them had been in the Burma police. They turned up. I don't know very much about it, actually. Mm. And then gradually a sort of a district commissioner were appointed. So it was just a sort of hiatus between the Jap surrender and I think a skeleton Burma civil administration had been trained up and was sitting back in India, where they were flown in, and gradually they took over the civil administration. It was just about a month or two when there was nothing except just us.
Who were you working to at that time?
Everyone?
Who were you working to? Was your chain of command at that time?
Oh, up through Brigade Headquarters.
Strictly military chain of command.
Oh, yes, yes. I was made in for certain areas, sort of, district officer, district superintendent. I only issued one order. There was a fishing village which had reputed to have the finest crayfish in Asia. The only order I issued was that my batman would have the first pick of the daily catch brought in. And my curried crayfish at my company outpost were the thing to be. People would come from a long way to have supper with me. That's why I'm a bit frivolous, but. But we
What were your responsibilities as district officer? What were you supposed to do?
I mean, just to keep law and order, really. So I just patrolled around. I mean, I didn't really do very much, actually. I mean, I didn't sort of have any sort of a. I think I went round and saw a few headmen and that sort of thing, but that was about all, really. Not much I could do. I mean, I had no resources. I mean, I had not much I really could do except just patrol around and make sure they didn't get stuck by dacoit. One interesting thing was that I did talk to the headman, or the head, I suppose, sort of mayor, I suppose, of this place, Chaito. I said, What happened when the Japanese came? And he said, well, after you British went out, after the dacoits started up again. And the Japanese put up with it for a bit. And then a Japanese regiment of three battalions was coming through the area. And they stopped for about 4 days. And anyway, they rounded up everybody who had any possible connections with dacoity, and he said, They brought me over here, and you see that big tree there? I said, yeah. He said, well, they sat all these chaps in a circle. They picked out a chap. They put a meat hook through his jaw and a rope, and they hauled him up onto that tree. And he said it took 3 days for this guy to die, and the rest of the chaps had to sit there and watch him. And he said there were no more dacoity. Well, I suppose that's one way of dealing with it.
Spectacular and exemplary punishment.
Yeah, I often thought about it. If you weigh up, I mean, it's absolutely against all our ideas of Christian justice. But in fact, practical term, that one act of barbarous thing probably saved more lives and more trouble than the sort of humane way of doing things. I'm not sure I'd like to make any deductions from that. But there comes a time when the risks of punishment are so awful that people won't do it. I'm not advocating it, but it's an interesting moral
dilemma.
But that's what happened anyway. And the dacoits thought, well, if this is what the fate in store, we're going to pack it in.
How did you get on with these headmen? Were they friendly and cooperative?
Yeah, I don't like the plain Burman a bit. I mean, I think that they'll change sides. They cooperated with us exactly the same way they cooperated with the Jap, I suppose. To be fair, they didn't like anybody ruling them very much. And they certainly... they were perfectly polite and pleasant and so on, and if you wanted water or something like that. But there wasn't any sort of warmth, I don't think. Unlike if you went into a village in India or somewhere, you know, where you were warmly welcomed because the sons of the village were probably serving in your regiment and there was a long tradition. There was nothing like that at all. They just regarded us as a necessary evil with whom they had to cooperate, which I suppose is a perfectly reasonable attitude, really.
What did your soldiers think of this activities?
Well, they were a bit fed up, really, because they all wanted to. Yeah, they were all tired. It was quite nice to be able to have, you know, two square meals a day and no guards and sleep. But they entered into it with enthusiasm. It's probably a good thing, anyway. I think we might have got out of hand a bit, actually.
What, with having nothing to do?
Nothing to do, really. Mm. See, it was no good having sort of ambitious training programs, because people think, why bother? So actually, I think, in a way, it kept them on their toes. And it was just sufficiently... It wasn't very dangerous. It wasn't like fighting Japanese, but it was just sufficiently dangerous enough just to keep them on the alert. And so probably it was quite a good thing, really.
Do you have any idea of the numbers of dacoits in your area, the scale of the threat you're up against?
No, not really, no. I mean, it wasn't a particularly... I mean, I believe a place called Tarawadi was up in the Irrawaddy Valley was very, very bad. But they seem to be all over Burma. I suppose, in our particular area, there were perhaps 50 or 60 of them, something like that. I can't remember if we ever managed to build up a sort of...
An intelligence
sort of order of battle of them. Yeah. I know this chap, Narmo, was the leader, and he'd been a professional dacoit before the war. I imagine that, in a way, they're rather like the IRA. He goes with a small band to a certain area, and then he calls up a few dacoit reserves to help him out for a bit of looting in an area. I've just imagined that is how they operated. There was a core of them, and then they called on supporters as necessary, rather as I think that the IRA... or any terrorist organisation, it has a core and then a large number of supporters and called upon. But I don't really know. I wish I knew more about it, actually, but I don't.
You said you were shot at with a shotgun. Mm. Evidently, he missed.
Mm.
What was their weaponry like generally?
Oh, they had one or two funny old rifles, but mostly DARs.
What are DARs?
I'll show you one if you want to. It's a machete with a long, thin, slightly curved blade, with a handle made of rope. It's quite they keep it. It's not a machete. I mean, it's a weapon and a tool as well. I mean, it's used for cutting jungle, cutting grass for feeding animals, cutting down bamboos. It's a general purpose sort of jungle weapon, like the parang or the simi in Kenya. It's not very high quality steel. It's not like a Jap sword, but it's sharp. It's quite a nasty weapon. I mean, it'll cut you, give you a very nasty wound. That was all. I mean, they weren't. They weren't really very effective. I mean, nowadays they'd doubtless have got Kalashnikovs and all sorts of sophisticated weapons. But we were better organized and better armed than they were. Surprisingly, they didn't have more Japanese weapons, but they didn't anyway.
Well, if as you suggest, the Japanese had frightened the wits out of them, presumably they kept clear of them.
Yes. But then they might have picked up some during the... Of course, the Japanese didn't, this particular, it wasn't like further west. I imagine that the dacoits in the Irrawaddy Valley and probably did pick up a lot of Japanese weapons left behind by those retreating Japanese, but this particular area, of course, the Japs hadn't retreated through it, so they weren't so easily available.
Now, time was going on at this stage, and plans were being made for the future of India, which eventually led to the partition and so on. But were you aware of that at the time, of what was looming?
Well, yes. Well, this, mind you, this was late 45, early 46. Yes. We were all very uncertain as to what the future was going to be. It was a bit... The future of India had not really... hadn't loomed up. All sorts of... I had been granted a regular commission in the Devonshire Regiment by this time. I wanted to stay on the Indian Army, but we were all... But most of the officers wanted to get home and get on with what they want to do with their lives outside the army. In my case, I was Indian Army, and nobody cared a bugger about how long I was stuffed out there. But suddenly, I then became gazetted as a lieutenant in the Devonshire Regiment.
How did that occur? Did you have anything to do with it directly yourself?
Well, I applied for. You see, I passed into Sandhurst, I think I told you, at the beginning of the war, and I was accepted by Sandhurst. Anyway, during the war in 1943, I went and attended a War Office Selection Board, which was a bit of a farce, really, because my CEO, all he wrote on me, this officer's my adjutant, nothing else. I went to him, I said, yes, excuse me, sir, would you think say a bit more? He said, that's what I'm saying. As luck would have it, the board commander was a major general who'd known my colonel on the frontier. So he said, oh, well, if you're good enough to be Pat Lindsay's adjutant, you're good enough for regular commissioner. And then we started talking about my CO. So it was a bit of a ludicrous thing, really. Anyway, I was suddenly gazetted. Demeterate. By this time, I was overdue for repatriation, and questions were being asked in the House of Commons as why is this chap and that chap, why is he not being brought back? So all of a sudden, somebody in GHQ India realised that I was a potential problem. So they then said that I would be repatriated.
Why was it the Devons? Had you applied to the Devons specifically?
Well, could my family come from Devon?
Had you known any anything about the regiment or members of the regiment?
Not at all, really, no. Way back, my father said, well, if you want to get in the army, I can't afford... He said, before the war, that you had to have money in the Devons, and my father hadn't got any money, and he's not to spare for me. And so that's why he said you better go into a decent British Indian regiment than a, what was regarded in those days as a rather a sort of bum British regiment. But I had to put...